Pakistan went to the IMF in 1958, just 11 years after its creation. Now more than 60 years, the current $3 billion deal is the country's 23rd IMF package. This dependence on foreign loans and aids have entangled the country in a never-ending economic crisis. Financial experts believe that the country will again be in need of another bailout package in the immediate future, thus limiting Pakistan's chances of coming out of the debt cycle.
A never-ending trade deficit, heavy borrowing to finance its spending, and poor debt management. Pakistan has been reduced to an economy that consumes more than it produces, relying on debt both from foreign and national sources. After the IMF deal, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are also expected to provide combined $3 billion in financing to Islamabad. Saudi Arabia has made its aid conditional to Pakistan's revamping of economic policies similar to the IMF rules. According to economic analysts, the manipulative external financial help reduces entrepreneurship opportunities, makes the country dependent on imports, discouraging the economic growth, thus preventing Pakistan to become self-reliant. Dealing with grueling repayments of its foreign debts, with record high inflation, the country is going to elections later this year. Some political commentators believe that procurement of the IMF financial package will be used by some political parties to secure their position in the upcoming election.
The initial draft of the 2023-24 budget failed to meet the IMF expectations. It was revised hurriedly to introduce new taxes and expenditure cuts to fulfill the conditions put forward by the global lender for loan bailouts. Economic analysts say the neoliberal policies that Islamabad has been trying to follow over the years to be granted loans by the IMF have not helped improve the lives of people, but instead have been fulfilling the interests of a section of elites.
The Central Bank of Pakistan has been asked by the World Monetary Body to remain proactive to control inflation. On the demand of IMF, the bank had to hike the key rate by 100 basis points after the financial organization objected to its unchanged rate. The power sector of Pakistan, which has been specifically mentioned by the IMF to rebase the tariffs timely, has raised prices for the consumers despite record high inflation in the present year. The IMF has also asked the country to withdraw import restrictions put in place for controlling external payments, as the cash-stripped country's reserves stand at $3.5 billion, barely enough to cover a month's imports. The other condition that the world lender has put forward is full commitment to a market-determined exchange rate without taking into consideration the fall of rupee to record lows in the recent weeks. Foreign affairs analysts have said the loan that IMF gives to countries like Pakistan is designed to trap a country in endless debt at the behest of the United States.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by economic analyst Mr. Javed Hassan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Hassan.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You're more than welcome. Now, Mr. Hassan, Pakistan has recently secured a $3 billion financial package from the IMF. Will it really offer relief to Pakistan's economic crisis, keeping in view the neoliberal economic policies Islamabad will have to adopt?
It will offer relief in the sense that Pakistan will avert default in the short run. Given that if we hadn't received this $3 billion bailout, Pakistan would have imminently faced potential default, which would have had severe impact on the populace as a whole. So in that, it has provided some relief to the people. Yes, I think so. But in that, it will improve the lifestyle and general welfare of the people. I don't think so. There's still a lot that has to be done. The economy still is in a very dire situation. There is still high inflation, near 30% inflation. There's still scarcity of essential goods. So I don't think it provides a lot of relief, but it does provide for things not getting worse.
Now, Mr. Hassan, financial experts have warned that the country will need another bailout package immediately. Now, you've hinted this before, but I want you to explain a bit more in detail. How is this dependence on loans and packages destroying Pakistan's economy?
The thing is that Pakistan has to, over the next 3 years, repay loans, principal repayments plus interest in the tune of something like $75 billion. Mm-hmm. If you include current account deficits of about $6 to $7 billion every year, then you're looking at a repayment external outflow of something like $91 billion. So this makes Pakistan highly dependent on external borrowing. This is not something which has happened just in the last few years. It has been a culmination of over 30 years or 35 years of bad policies. Pakistan does not export enough. Pakistan does not produce enough to cover its own requirements. So it has to import much more than it can export. As a result, it is highly dependent on foreign inflows. It gets some inflows through remittances and also some from exports, but that is not sufficient to cover the imports that it has. As a result, it has continuously borrowed, and the borrowing is now having to be repaid. So there is no avoidance of this. At some point, I think Pakistan will need to restructure its debt and such that it gets some fiscal space to spend on its people and grow. Right now, there is no such space.
Like you mentioned, sir, it's been happening for decades now. So the current IMF deal in Pakistan is Pakistan's 24th package since the formation in 1947. So do you see Islamabad coming out of this debt cycle?
Not in the near term, no. Unfortunately not. If anything, the debt cycle is getting worse. The government borrowing is even higher than it has been in the past. The speed at which government borrowing and government debt is increasing is accelerating rather than decelerating. There is nothing to suggest that Pakistan is getting out of its difficulties. What we have from the IMF loan is a short-term reprieve. It is not a cancellation of the debt sentence. So we are just basically postponing difficulties that are going to come in not too distant future.
That's right. So you've mentioned bad policies in your second question. Now, the long political turmoil in the country is regarded as an important reason for the failing economy. In what way are the opportunistic political policies contributing to the deepening financial crisis?
Well, the lack of comprehensive mandate or the ability of the political forces to do what is necessary in the economy, it really compounds the difficulties. To start with, Pakistan has a very low tax to GDP ratio. It's below 10% and continues to remain below 10%. Numerous think tanks, including IMF, have repeatedly suggested that Pakistan needs to broaden its tax base so that if it borrows its tax base, it can generate more revenues. Once it does that, it probably needs to borrow less. But given the political expedience that politicians have, they don't want to tax the retail sector, they don't want to tax the agricultural sector, they don't want to tax the property sector. Given all this, a large share of the economy is not taxed, and because the same people are taxed more and more, given that they are taxed more and more, they become more inefficient, and the other sectors continue to grow. So effectively, what we have is insufficient tax base, more and more borrowing from both domestic and external sources. So we are actually increasing the difficulties rather than reducing it. And there is no sign of a major change in policy direction as of now.
Thank you, sir. There you have it, Mr. Javed Hassan from Islamabad. He's an economic analyst. Thank you for being on the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
More than welcome. And now let's see how people have reacted to the recent IMF bailout package secured by Pakistan.
Euphoric, a technology learner interested in music, photography and spirituality, tweeted, "Nothing new for Pakistan. It is like having a credit card from Chinese, Saudi, Turkey, UAE, World Bank, IMF and using the money to pay here and there and put a bandage on an incurable disease." Erica Brown, a China observer and UN consultant from the US, tweeted, Why will Pakistan remain a slave country forever? Because autonomous nations do not rely on loans, aid and remittances from other countries. Pakistan exists because since independence it is living on foreign aid. Steve Hank, professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, tweeted, debt-ridden countries like Pakistan are kidding themselves if they think passing the begging bowl to the IMF and taking on more IMF debt will solve their problems. Zaid Ahmed, a netizen from Pakistan, tweeted, it's indeed temporary positive development for Pakistan, but again after some time we will again run to IMF and make life of people harsher and harsher.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
The recent reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia, brokered by China, has opened up a new chapter of possibilities, presenting both economic opportunities and strategic benefits for Pakistan. Strategic affairs experts believe that the restoration of diplomatic ties and the resumption of bilateral cooperation between these two significant players in the Middle East can pave the way for enhanced trade, energy connections, and stability in the region. With Pakistan's geographic proximity to both Iran and Saudi Arabia, this reconciliation presents significant opportunities for the South Asian countries' economic and regional influence.
Iran has long been an important trading partner for Pakistan, while Saudi Arabia remains a major economic ally, with a large Pakistani diaspora contributing to its workforce and remittance inflows. Analysts say that the restoration of diplomatic ties will form a conducive environment for trade and investment, benefiting Pakistan's economy and providing a much-needed boost to the South Asian Muslim country. Pakistan's close ties with China in the context of China's Belt and Road Initiative, coupled with the restoration of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, presents a unique opportunity to align the interests of all parties involved. This alignment, according to financial experts, is believed to contribute to the success of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and the broader BRI, fostering economic growth and regional integration. Furthermore, recent steps taken by Pakistan and Iran to open up the trade market at the common border have paved the way for discussions on currency swap agreement and transit mechanisms between Tehran and Islamabad.
Tensions in the Middle East have long been a cause of concern, but the Iran-Saudi détente marks a turning point in the complex geopolitics of the Middle East. Regional experts maintain that Pakistan, with its balanced approach and historical efforts to mediate between Iran and Saudi Arabia, stands poised to capitalize on the positive momentum. By maintaining diplomatic ties with both the nations, Pakistan can act as a bridge, fostering dialogue and cooperation, ultimately contributing to a more stable and prosperous region.
Proximity between Tehran and Riyadh has a significant impact on Pakistan's internal security and political stability. Historically, Saudi Arabia has closely monitored Pakistan's relations with Iran, exerting pressure on Islamabad to toe its line. However, this recent agreement eliminates a significant obstacle, allowing Pakistan to expand trade and strategic cooperation with both Iran and Saudi Arabia. The Iran-Saudi Reconciliation Agreement, despite having economic benefits, serves as an opportunity for Pakistan to address sectarian tensions within its borders. Foreign affairs analysts believe by reducing tensions and promoting religious tolerance, this reconciliation can help alleviate the sufferings of Pakistan's significant Shia population, helping to create an atmosphere of harmony and coexistence.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst and author Mr. Mir Muhammad Ali Khan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ali Khan.
Thank you so much, brother.
You're welcome, sir. Now let's begin with the questions. The normalization of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia opens up new opportunities for trade and economic cooperation. So my question is, how can Pakistan use this development to maximize its economic potential?
First of all, my congratulations as a Pakistani that relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have normalized. I love this. Until Pakistan comes out of the American bloc, I don't think we can benefit anything from this. I want Pakistan to benefit from this, and there's so much Pakistan can gain, but Pakistan politicians are absolutely influenced by America. If Iran and Saudi Arabia can have normalization of ties, then Pakistan can stand up for its own rights, and Iran being our neighbor, Saudi Arabia being a country which Pakistan has long-standing brotherly relationship with, it is a wonderful omen for Pakistan if it comes out of the American bloc. Until then, I don't think much can be done.
Now, sir, away from the economic aspect of it, the improved relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have the potential to reduce sectarian tensions in Pakistan. How can Islamabad leverage this opportunity to promote religious tolerance and coexistence within its borders?
If Pakistan does not control its internal bigotry of organizations, now it is the perfect time to say that none of the countries are supporting, neither of the countries are supporting anything here. Pakistan needs to crack down. We have seen tens of thousands of sectarian killings in Pakistan from both sides. This is the best opportunity to close down those outlets that spread sectarian violence, sectarian bigotry. Those must need to be closed down. And those other countries that always demand from Pakistan that sectarian violence be finished, I think they do have a logical demand from Pakistan. And this is the best opportunity for Pakistan, because now we cannot have any excuse that Iran is supporting anything or Saudi is supporting anything. This excuse has worked some logically and some illogically, but now there is no excuse left.
That's right, Mr. Ali Khan. Now, we know that the renewal of Iran-Saudi relations could also help diffuse regional rivalries. How can Pakistan seize this opportunity to reduce the influence of extremist groups and enhance the security and also stability?
Economic betterment is absolutely related to security of any country. When we control this extremism within our own country, we can, along with Iran, we can become a regional group of countries more powerful than anything which has been witnessed in the past 25, 30, 40, 50 years. Iran is our neighbor. Iran is one of the largest oil producers, gas producers. Why are we shying away from having a economic tie with Iran? With collaboration of Iran, we can get cheaper oil. And transfer of technology, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, Malaysia, there's so many countries that can have a block, an economic block. Why can't we have an economic block that benefits Pakistan and the region? Afghanistan is opened up. Iran is working with Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia is working with Afghanistan. Why can't we put up an economic bloc for this region that benefits everything and have cordial relationship with America? Let not America dictate to us what Pakistan should do and Pakistan should not do. The biggest problem is that we have lost out on economic betterment with Iran when it comes to vis-a-vis Pakistan and Iran because of the fact that we are always being dictated by America.
So, sir, one of the reasons could be the sanctions. So what could these two countries do?
You see, the sanction is a sword that America hangs on every country. Iran has had sanctions. Isn't Iran growing? I've been to Iran so many times. I see that country growing. Why didn't America, if Saudi Arabia and Pakistan can have great ties. Iran and Saudi Arabia can have great ties. We can have great ties with both the countries without having any sanctions. Why should? Sanctions are not that easy to put. Those days are gone. This globalized world, we can't have sanctions put on us like that without any reason. Doing business with Iran, so the whole world is doing business with Iran. Why can't Pakistan do business with Iran?
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, let's talk about CPEC as well, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It's an integral part of the larger Belt and Road Initiative. So how can improved relations between Iran, Saudi Arabia and China further enhance the prospects of CPEC and also promote regional economic integration?
CPEC, one of the biggest investments of CPEC has been in Pakistan, of the biggest investments of BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, part, which is the parent project of China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Having Iran and Saudi Arabia both join CPEC along with Afghanistan, the route, the land route alone can go all the way to Europe. Pakistan can benefit so much by having Iran into CPEC. Saudi Arabia has already shown its interest to develop a $20 billion refinery city in Gwadar. Iran can do the same for Pakistan, and we can together rise. We need economic betterment. No betterment can come without economic betterment, and no economic betterment can come without holding hands with your neighbors. We can't have, we can't be not doing business with our neighbor because somebody 8,000 miles away in America says that we can't. Those days are gone. This is not 1970s and 80s where there is a Soviet bloc and there is an American bloc. Now this is a globalized world. And in this globalized world, we need to hold hands. And we need, as a Pakistani, I'm saying this, we need to think about Pakistan and Pakistani people rather than still being scared of the Western world.
There you have it, political analyst and author, Mr. Mir Muhammad Ali Khan from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome, sir. And now, let's take a look at how the global media has covered the Iran-Saudi relations and its impact on Pakistan.
Michael Kugelman, director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center, tweeted, "This China-mediated Iran-Saudi Arabia reconciliation is a black swan event, a surprise, rare watershed moment for international relations that will have major ripple effects across the globe, including South Asia, especially Pakistan, where Iran-KSA rivalry has played out heavily." Isa Ali, a researcher, wrote, "Reconciliation between Saudi and Iran benefits Pakistan. It will help Pakistan maintain a more balanced relationship between the two nations. As things stand, Saudi Arabia has financially been very helpful to Pakistan, whereas Iran is a regional trading partner." Naveed Aman Khan, an editor, political analyst and columnist, wrote, "Reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Iran would be of great relief for Muslims across the world, especially Pakistan. Pakistan needs to have strong, balanced ties with the two countries. On the other hand, Chinese diplomacy is winning well-deserved appreciation." Waqas Aslam Rana, a political commentator, tweeted, "China's foray into Middle East and South Asia, plus Saudi-Iranian detente, is opening up new opportunities for Pakistan. In particular, the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline, vital for our energy security, but for long blocked by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, may now have a chance."
And that was our episode on IMF damaging the economic basis of Pakistan and the friendly relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia set to benefit the South Asian Muslim country. We'll meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
France's ban on hijab in women's football is an act of state racism. The ban on hijab in football is not about keeping sports equal. It's about denying access to those who aren't deemed French enough. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reported, France's top administrative court ruled last month that the French Football Federation, FFF, could continue to ban hijab-wearing players from the pitch. The decision effectively strips hijab-wearing women from all opportunities to participate in the beautiful game, playing, coaching, officiating, and participating at any level of football in France. The issue behind all of this is rooted in laïcité, the French concept of secularism, and the reason the FFF wants to keep religious symbols away from football. The FFF maintains that permitting hijabs on or near the pitch goes against a 1905 law on secularism. But Les Hijabis, a collective of young women in France challenging the FFF's discriminatory policy, have argued that several non-Muslim players sign crosses before going out on the pitch and have tattoos of Christian figures and symbols that are in plain sight. The rule is therefore not being evenly applied. It is primarily being enforced on brown and black women who are Muslim and wear headscarves. Players of the highest echelon of women's football will be gathering in Australia and New Zealand to compete in the Women's World Cup. The court's ruling is a slap in the face to anyone advocating for gender equity in football, let alone mere weeks before an international event aimed at providing greater opportunity and representation for women athletes. But so few even know, and even fewer care to speak out. Those who do know remain deafeningly silent or unconcerned because, as is often the case, those in power are largely unaffected by policies disproportionately marginalizing racialized women and girls. In May 2020, Les Hijabos began advocating for the right to play football by staging public matches and inviting the media to capture them enjoying the sport. Their scarves flying in the wind, they hosted a tournament in December and raised money for Female Guides of Kilimanjaro. They collaborated with groups that support social justice initiatives around France, including Alliance Citoyenne. They play against other women and girls who are not Muslim or who may not wear hijab. Many of their supporters rightly see this as a human rights issue. More than anything, this group of women want to play football. They want to manifest their love of the sport by actually playing. They also want the game they love to embrace them in return. At the moment, football in France is not allowed to love them back. Not only do French sports authorities show such clear disdain for hijab-wearing girls and women, but they also want to keep them benched. The International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, first disallowed hijabs in 2007, but struck down their own ban on March 1, 2014. There was an effort from within those in the football ecosystem to bring hijab into the global fold. They were successful. From that, women's football began to expand and grow. Every country in the world made accommodations except France, which has only doubled down on its discriminatory policies and imposed a law that knowingly excludes women and girls from the right to play sports. The issue of banning hijab from sports is not new. France's rigidity on this issue is not about keeping sports equal. It is about denying access to those who aren't deemed French enough. Black and brown African, Arab or South Asian Muslim women and girls are not hiding, and they will not shy away from their faith and right to cover. And what will happen in 2024 when the Paris host the Summer Olympics? Will athletes be conveniently discouraged from coming to France to compete? Will the world rejoice in the role of sports as a unifying agent while hijab-wearing women in France are denied the opportunity to showcase the triumph of their human spirit? Imagine a player being benched for an international friendly because she's donning a sports hijab while playing. This is unacceptable in sports, but France is upholding hateful, racist laws. For the sanctity of a sport or the peace of mind of Islamophobes?
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear listeners, sisters and brothers, the loyal family of IRIB English Radio. There is a beautiful story of a beggar who lived all of his life under one tree. Each day he would go out into the village and beg for some dry breadcrumbs to sustain his life. For 40 years, and the beggar lived under the same tree, pleading with the people to give him some food. Day by day, he became weaker, and finally one day he passed quietly into death. When the villagers found him, they decided to bury his ashes under the tree, where he lived out his life. As they began to dig in order to place his ashes deep in the ground, they found a treasure chest, a chest full of gold, diamonds, and jewels, a mere 6 inch below the ground. Well, this was just the opening to a new episode of For a Better Life. Just like always, I remind you of the very fact that I'm not going to teach you anything. I'm in love with literature, and analyzing the stuff and commenting on them is one of my most favorite things to do. So, yes, this is IRIB English Radio, and I hope you're doing well whenever you are. So it hasn't been so long, so you should remember the story that I told you at the very beginning of today's episode. It was about a beggar who spent his entire life begging for things without knowing that underneath him, just underneath the ground that he was sitting, rests so much of diamonds and gold and things like that, a treasure, just like the treasures that we human beings search for every now and then in our lives. Yes, too frequently in life, we are also like this beggar running here and there, searching, begging for that which we need to fulfill our lives. We are searching and yearning for peace, happiness, and God. We go here, we go there, we search this place, we search that place, but that priceless and crucial peace and happiness still eludes us. If only we would sit still for a moment and go deeper within and never forget that the treasure chest is inside of us, flowing through our veins. It is not some external thing to be obtained or found. Rather, we could say that the divine joy that we're searching for is in our heart, in our breath, and in our blood. We have it in a Persian poem that says that the treasure that you're seeking for rests inside of you. And that's the very truth about life. We go here and there in pursuit of happiness and pursuit of prosperity, but we do not know that the main and the most important prosperity and treasure is inside of ourselves. The things that we're seeking for most of the time are the things that are in front of us, but we just do not notice them. We do not see them as if we're blind. We turn a blind eye to every single one of those treasures just because we think happiness or prosperity is somewhere else. While we're very much wrong, life is all about these little, very tiny moments and details that we spend with our family. We spend of our lifetime, of course, even if it's not doing anything, even if it's just a soul-searching drama, even if it's just getting into the fields or going into a village, watching the surroundings, watching the skies, watching the lakes, watching all the beautiful things, a single small butterfly that comes and sits on your finger. So all of these little tiny things are considered the treasures because every single one of them are going to sparkle something new into your brain and are going to bring some new manifestations into your thought. And then just as those moments of manifestation happen, you might be an inventor. You might turn into a writer. You might write a poem. You might do big and great things. You might start to find a new medicine if you're a student of medicine. Then just by a moment of relief and by a moment of going deep into your thought in peace of mind, you could get to find the remedies for all the diseases that exist in today's world. So these are not stories and miracles that we talk about. These are just the normal life, even, let me just say, the ordinary life, that we should learn how to, you know, seize it, how to understand it, how to make the most out of it, how to feel happy and content with every moment of it. So I guess right now is the best time for us to go for a little bit of a change of mood and then we'll be back. So don't go anywhere.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Being content with what you have already is an art form. It leads to peace that can't be replaced by anything else. So this is IRB English Radio. You are listening to For a Better Life. I am Asma and we're talking about life. I have seen this movie about the pursuit of happiness. I guess everybody has seen that and it's been long ago that's been released, so it is one of the classics by now. The thing that really enchanted my thought and idea was the fact that really we did not give it a thought. Life is just the moments that are fleeting, and the thing that we search for, it lays in front of our eyes and we just do not see it. The fact that you have a family, the fact that you are healthy, the fact that you can work so hard to get what you want is a blessing. That is the happiness. And, you know, the modern life has got too many problems within itself. One of those problems is the fact that people think if they have more money, they're going to be more prosperous and happier. But it's wrong, because there are many wealthy people. I hate to sound like so idealistic people and those kind of people who say things that they do not believe in it. But trust me, whatever I say in here, whatever I share in these monologues are the things that I think about them, and I believe in them, because you cannot preach people the things you're not practicing. I guess that's a fact. I cannot say things I do not myself believe in. So, happiness is the smile of my father and my mother. Happiness is the health that I have. And happiness is the family time that we sit together. So when you sit alone with yourself, try to ask some questions like this from yourself. What is happiness according to me? What are the things that I would consider as happiness in my life? And what are the things that I cannot live without? Sometimes we're not going to get the meaning of life unless we lose the life that we already are living in it and we're a part of it. But since we're living in the hustles and bustles of this busy life that we're living, sometimes we just forget to count them or be thankful from Allah for giving all of these blessings to me as one person. So now that I can breathe easily, now that I am considered as the healthy people who can live with their family, who can see the smile of their parents, of their siblings, of their loved ones, so I am happy and I am prosperous, and all the happiness that I'm searching for in this world just exists in me. I shouldn't just search for it in another place of the world. I suppose everything starts from within. Just go for your insight and then try to count the blessings that you have, and then you would see where the true happiness is resting. Yes, we are running out of time. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Since January, the Zionist regime has endorsed 12,855 housing units for settlers throughout the West Bank. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, the Zionist regime has endorsed 12,855 housing units for settlers throughout the occupied West Bank since January. Peace Now said it is the highest number the group has recorded since it started tracking such activity in 2012. Peace Now said in a statement, in the past 6 months, the only sector that Israel has vigorously promoted is the settlement enterprise. According to the group, the Higher Planning Council, HPC, of the Zionist regime convened three times this year with the objective of advancing construction proposals. All Zionist settlements beyond 1967 borders are illegal under the international law. According to the United Nations, nearly 700,000 settlers live in 279 settlements across the West Bank and East Al-Quds, up from 520,000 in 2012. Last month, the Zionist regime planned to authorize 1,000 new homes for Ili settlement in the occupied West Bank in response to the shooting that killed four Zionist settlers. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that he and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich agreed to move ahead immediately with the planning. No further timetable was provided. A new resolution gives practically all control over planning approval in the occupied West Bank to Smotrich, who is himself a settler and a fierce proponent of settlement expansion. The decision, which takes immediate effect, speeds up the process of expanding occupied West Bank settlements and retroactively legalizes settlements under the Zionist regime's law. And earlier this month, the Zionist regime two-day assault on Jenin refugee camp left at least 12 Palestinians killed and more than 100 wounded. Almost a third of the refugee camp, around 4,000 Palestinians, fled their homes, according to the Palestinian Red Crescent. Around 1,000 Israeli regime troops were used in the operation, which saw attack helicopters being used alongside drones, fighter jets, and heavy weapons, resulting in numerous properties being damaged or destroyed. Legal experts have said that the Zionist regime's military operation in Jenin fits into the parameters of war crimes under the Geneva Conventions. The official Palestinian news agency Wafa reported a group of settlers from the illegal settlement of Karni Shomron attacked the Palestinian Bedouin community of Arab Al-Koli and pelted residents with stones, injuring four Palestinians. The settlers also set a stall on fire in the community. The Palestinian Ministry of Health said the wounded Palestinians were admitted to the Qalqilya Public Hospital as a result of the assault. It said two Palestinians were in critical condition as they had suffered fractures in the skull and lacerations in the face. More than 700,000 Israelis live in over 279 settlements built since the 1967 Zionist regime occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. While all Zionist settlements are illegal under international law, the occupying regime has stepped up settlement expansion in blatant violation of the United Nations Security Council resolutions. Wafa also reported, as part of their efforts to destroy the Palestinian habitat, The Zionist regime terrorist settlers recently pumped wastewater into Palestinian agricultural lands in the village of Nahalin, west of Beit Lahem, polluting crops and a water spring. Hassan Brejie, director of the Beit Lahem Office of the Wall and Settlement Resistance Commission, told Wafa that settlers from the illegal settlement of Bitar Elite built on lands from the villages of Nahalin, Wadi Fakin and Hassan pumped their wastewater into Nahalin lands, contaminating a water spring the residents use for various purposes and agricultural land planted with different types of crops. He said the Bitar elite settlers always deliberately pump their wastewater into those areas which cause serious environmental pollution and health hazard.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical contaminations. But that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 metres of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites, or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay, but all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the latlongs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone.